This is Aaron Palmer with 307 Net Radio, and I'm sitting down with State Senator Dave Kinski, who is at the legislative session in Cheyenne, which will wrap up later this week. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning. How are you today, Aaron?
Very good. Thank you. And you?
I'm well. The sky's blue. There's not a lot of blowing snow, so I may actually get home this week, so I'm delighted.
Okay, we've got a bunch of questions here for you, Senator. The first is, last week you talked about House Bill 74, which was the Wyoming Outdoor Trust, and at that point you said you were okay with the idea of supporting the Wyoming Outdoors program, but minus the trust. And this last week you voted to pass that. So I just wanted to give you a chance to explain why you passed that, because obviously there were changes in the bill that prompted you to say, well, I can get behind this now. So tell me about what happened there, please.
Well, first of all, Aaron, I always reserve the right to change my mind, and I always reserve the right to say, well, you know, maybe I was wrong. I still don't like the trust very much. For the reasons I stated previously, it just puts spending on autopilot. What kind of swung me around on this one is that the money to build the trust is coming out of the travel and tourism tax, you know, the tax on hotel rooms, which I opposed. But once it's here, you know, we need to use it for the purposes intended. It's coming out of that tax, and this whole concept was actually endorsed by the entire Wyoming Travel and Tourism Board and the Director of Wyoming Travel and Tourism. So that makes you reconsider. You know, it's their money. It's not. It's taxpayers' money, but it's money that is set aside specifically for tourism. And then I heard from folks like one of my colleagues from the Southwest, where they've really got this budding business of people that are coming in ATVs. And they want to scoot around on back roads, dirt roads, and it's growing. And so they want to use some of this funds to connect some of those roads to really help build that business. And travel and tourism is behind using this trust for that purpose. So I thought, well, you know, if it's truly going to be used for tourism, then that's different. The next thing that happened is an amendment that did say, instead of outdoors, they said outdoors with an emphasis on tourism. That's one of the amendments that passed. Because before that, when it says outdoors, what does that mean? I mean, that could mean locking up wilderness acreage. Who knows? So the amendment was made it clear that we're going to use these funds specifically to promote tourism. And the other thing is that there was a requirement that the process by which the board selected the projects be public, that they reach out and take opportunity for public input. So I thought the bill was greatly improved, and in the end, I decided to vote for it. You know, none of these things are just clear black and white. This one, I thought on balance, was worth support. I still don't like the idea of trust, but this might be the exception that proves the rule.
One of the things that people, at least in Sheridan, Johnson counties, that I have heard is talking about is property tax reform, and everybody is going, what the heck happened in the legislature? One bill out of 20 plus that were brought to the legislative session passed. So can you tell me what happened and why?
I wish I could. My reaction is the same as yours. 21 property tax bills and one survives. You got to be kidding me. What did just happen? And the two best, one was the property tax reduction. That's the lone survivor. And that passed both the House and the Senate. And that's going to go to the governor's desk, I hope, for his signature. And it's just partial relief. It's relief for those most in need, those with the lowest incomes and the fewest assets. So I get that, and that's worthy. But property tax for everybody else just died. And I wish I could explain it. I can't. What we kicked out of the Senate was a property tax relief bill for everybody across the board. It was a good bill. It took a lot of work to get it out of the Senate. It went over the House, and it was up for debate in the House on Tuesday night, and there were only like six or seven bills left, and they shut down debate at 8 o'clock. Why is completely beyond me. I mean, you know, if you can get to that bill, get to that bill. You know, if you got to be there till midnight, then be there till midnight. So I don't know what happened. You know, it's difficult to get things done in the legislature in the American political system for a reason. That's the way the founders set it up. But for Pete's sake, property tax relief ought to be one heck of a lot easier than this. And I share your puzzlement. I do not know what happened. I wish I could explain it. Okay. You know, it's a body of people, and you just with people you just never know. And I'm as puzzled as you are.
Okay, so
and I'll tell you what, frankly, a little bit angry and frustrated. If there were ever a year to do it, when we're just awash in all this extra money, one-time money granted, but there, after a run-up of 20%, 30% in property tax valuations, we ought to be able to give some of that back. And it just, I don't know.
Where do we go from here? Obviously, this session, it's dead. Nothing's going to happen. But what about next year? What can legislators do to bring this back? Are you planning on bringing it back? And what happens next?
Well, absolutely planning on bringing it back. I think that we have a great chairman of revenue in the Senate, Bo Beitman of Sheridan. And worked with me on that one bill that affected a rate reduction in the assessment. And I think he's going to work on it in that committee in the interim. And I've told him I'll do anything I can to help. And I think the best thing that we can do is try and rally support around a bill, not 21, but a bill, and get as many people putting their shoulder behind that one as we possibly can.
All right, let's switch gears here. Local governments are keeping an eye on direct distribution. And my understanding is that something's been done. So can you explain what happened? Did they get more money? Are they getting less money? Exactly what can local governments expect in direct distribution?
So the direct distribution is a handout from Cheyenne to cities, towns, and counties that, depending on the city, town, or county, can be 4 or 5% of their budget to 20% of their budget. And so for some of these towns, it's just critical, especially the smaller towns and the poorer counties. And in the main budget passed last year, it was $105 million. And the governor recommended putting another $26 million into it. And that's what passed both the House and the Senate, is an additional $26 million. And that sounds like a lot. But when you spread it out amongst 99 towns and cities and 23 counties, it gets spread thin pretty fast. But, you know, every little bit helps. The long run, cities and towns and counties have to have an ability to raise revenue on their own. One of the long-time revenue committee chairmen pointed out there's a study of the 50 states, Wyoming, localities, towns, cities, and counties are able to supply the lowest amount of their budget from local taxes. In other words, they are the most dependent on money coming out of Cheyenne, more so than 49 other states. And so that's something that has to change. And now here's the difficulty in that, Aaron. I was on revenue committee, and there was a bill that said, hey, cities, towns, counties, we're going to give you the authority to go out to the voters and get another penny. Keep 100% of it. You know, the 4% sales tax, they only get to keep a third. Here, you can have another penny, keep all of it. Or, you know, levy another couple mills. They didn't want it. Why? Well, we don't want to have to go out and ask the voters for a tax increase. Well, okay, so don't complain when you have to depend too much on Cheyenne for your money. you know, pick your poison. I've always strongly believed that a local tax voted upon by local people is far better than dancing to Cheyenne's tune. But I couldn't get, you know, fellow mayors and county commissioners to buy into that. They're like, no, we don't want, ooh, no. And that's I'm sorry for that. I think they'd be better to say, sure, give us the authority and we will go out to the voters and make the case. That's how the two pennies we've got now work. Right? Yep. You've got two pennies, and every 4 years you have to go out and justify to the voters why that's on the ballot. And if you do that and you're honest and you do that well, it gets 2/3 of the support. Then you go over, you look at Johnson County. There's been a couple of times their 1 cent, one of the 1 cents, I think it was the cap tax, failed because they went to the voters and the voters weren't convinced that it was a good use of the money. Hey, that's the way America should work. And I think that that's the way it ought to work at the local level. But, you know, I have a hard time sometimes getting buy-in on that.
This year, and maybe I'm mistaken, but it seems like from what I've seen in the legislature this year, there were a lot more bills that just died in this year's session than in previous sessions. Now, I guess I wanted to get your take on that. Is that the case, or am I seeing something weird? Or what exactly happened, and why do you feel so many bills died this year in the legislature?
Well, there's something going on. So let's back up a little bit, Aaron. There's just something about this session that's different from prior sessions, and I can't put my finger on it, but it has been exhausting. And at first I thought it was just me. Well, then I started talking to some other senators and I said, this is like in the first 2 weeks, does this seem like this has been a rough session? This one guy says, I feel like we've been down here a month. We've been down here a week and a half. And I'd say, what is it? Don't know. And then I thought, well, maybe I'm just talking to like-minded individuals. So I started, you know, picking out people that I don't ordinarily hang with, you know, and I got the same feedback. So is there something in the air? I don't know. And so it does seem like it's just been more difficult. Have there been more bills die? It sure seems like it to me. And have we processed fewer bills? It sure seems like it to me. Yet, just last night, I was having dinner with the Senate Minority Floor Leader. And I told him, I said, you know, wow, the pace of work doesn't seem as brutal as it has in years past. And I told him, I said, I think it's because you're not keeping us there till 10:30 at night, like it's happened in the past sometimes. And he said, you know, he went and checked the numbers, and we had considered as many bills this year as we have on average in prior years. No different. And I was shocked, as was he, because it seemed to him and to me and many others that we'd handled a lot of bills and killed a lot more. He said, no, it's about average. And I told him, well, is it in the Senate? Are we just talking less than we used to? Are we just more efficient? Don't know. So before I conclude that we've killed more bills than we have in the past, I need to go back and check the statistics, because it could be that our mind is playing a trick on us there. So I want to go back and check to see if it's really the case that we've killed more than in the past. I do know one thing that the majority floor leader told me is that he started putting bills out on the floor much more quickly than we have in past years. So the traditional habit had been a bill gets introduced on Monday, it gets assigned to a committee, they hear it on Tuesday, it comes out back to the floor on Wednesday. What he was doing is, if they consider it Tuesday morning, he put it up on the board Tuesday afternoon. So we were shortening the cycle by quite a bit. I also do believe, I think there was a lot less talking than there has been in prior years. Some of these bills, they're frequent flyers, you know, like Medicaid expansion. We have had years where we would go for 3 hours debating that, and that debate was pointless. Not a single vote was changed from where people stood at the beginning of the debate. This year, 15 minutes. And it's not that it's not important, it's just Everybody had their minds made up. So why stand up and flog it for 3 hours when you know how the vote's going to go? I mean, within one vote, you know how that's going to come out before the bill ever hits the floor, which means it was dead, DOA. So there's any number of reasons why the workflow seems different. I don't know what it is, and I don't know why this year seems different than other years. Maybe with the hindsight, the benefit of hindsight, we'll be able to better figure it out. But it's been a different year, that's for sure.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the Freedom Caucus. And the reason I bring this up is because in the media, they have been, on one hand, chastised for all of the problems in the legislature. And then on the other hand, some people are looking at them saying, well, wait a minute, they're getting, you know, a bad rap here. What exactly, in your opinion, is it? Are they creating a problem in the legislature or not? And if so, how do we correct this?
Well, first of all, just so that your listeners know, the Freedom Caucus is purely a House phenomenon, and I'm in the Senate. So I'm sort of in the same position as the public and as you, Aaron. I'm an observer. I mean, I'm closer to it, but I still am not on the inside like those folks are. The way that I understand the Freedom Caucus, it's been around for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years. And if you get those folks that have been in it for a while and you sit them down and say, kind of give me the backstory, what they'll tell you is there was a few individuals in leadership on the House side who were not conservative. And not only that, they went out of their way to ostracize conservatives, marginalize them, disrespect them. So the conservatives then banded together and started the Freedom Caucus as a way to try and come together in solidarity to resist that. And let me tell you, you know, things in the legislature, they come and go. Every legislative body has kind of its different personality. Like I was talking to one senator that's been there decades. I said, you know, it seems to me that there's been a session or two where some of the politics almost been kind of smash mouth. And he said, yeah, you know, and one or two individuals who have that style can their leadership to do that. But he said, it's not always been that way. You know, one or two people leave the legislature and then the whole mode can change. So to give the Freedom Caucus people their due, their viewpoint is, we were marginalized, we came together to try and stand on common ground. The folks on the other side of it would say, oh, they're so radical. There was no dealing with them. There was no compromising with them. You know, to heck with them. And so, I who knows what the reality of it is, but once they're there, they're there. And, you know, they need to be dealt with. Now they are not, and you watch the elections, they are about anywhere from 1 to 4 votes shy of being able to command a majority on most issues. But they are organized, they're demanding transparency. He's not a member of the Freedom Caucus, but he's certainly sympathetic to them. Chip Nyman is the majority floor leader, and he was elected by the body. By a majority of the Republicans, and that says something. And I'm sorry for the coughing, Aaron. Chip Nyman says, look, you know, we just had a red wave in Wyoming where a lot of conservatives were elected, and we deserve to have a share of management. We deserve to have a share of power. Well, how do you argue with that? So they actually have kind of a divided governance structure. On the House side, you've got the Speaker, who's not a Freedom Caucus guy. Chip Nyman is next in command, and he's not in the Freedom Caucus, but certainly he's sympathetic with them. Then you have the Speaker pro tem, and he's, you know, kind of in the middle. he's one that says, hey, we need to respect, you know, both the moderates and the hardcore conservatives. And then I can't remember what the rest of the positions are, but they're not Freedom Caucus positions. And so, you know, I can't blame or hang anything on Freedom Caucus any more than I can on those who oppose the Freedom Caucus. It's a deliberative body. Passions run high. Views are strongly held. And I don't know that I would blame the Freedom Caucus for anything. They're trying to do the job the best they can for the people who elected them, like everybody down here is.
Fair enough. Let's talk specifically about a couple of bills, because there's been some changes to them, and I just kind of wanted to get your take on this. First one is Senate File 133, which is basically no males in female sports. And that passed the Senate, and it's since gone to the House, and they've made some changes to that. So can you explain those changes? And that's going to have to come back to the Senate for concurrence. And do you see that happening with the amendments that they put in there?
So as I understand, so first let's talk about Senate File 133. That says, if genetically you were born a male and you decide you want to transition to female through hormone treatments, surgery, whatever, that's fine. But you cannot compete in girls' sports. It's unfair to girls. And during the debates in the Senate, people tried to say, well, it's bigotry. No, it's not. You know, God bless all people. It's not bigotry. It's fairness to young girls. We've seen it all across the country where young women are on track to earn college scholarships or to win in NCAAs. And then a biological transitioning male enters and sweeps all the medals. That's not fair to young women. It's just not fair. And so I resist anybody that says it's bigotry. It's bias. It's not. I wish no harm or ill will to anybody, but we need to be fair to young women. So this bill simply says, if genetically you were born a male, you can't compete in female sports, you know, even though you're going through a transition with hormone treatment and so forth. So what happened in the House is they amended it to say it applies to high school only, as opposed to college. Why that is, I don't know. Because I think if you're a 20-year-old young lady in college trying to compete in track, you deserve as much fairness as a 15-year-old young lady competing in track in high school. So that change is going to come back over to the Senate. Typically what happens is when a bill is amended and it comes back to the other side to say, do you concur or not? The person that really drives that decision is the sponsor of the bill. And that's Wendy Schuler from Evanston, a former Olympic athlete, basketball athlete, lifetime teacher of physical education, lifetime women's basketball coach. And Wendy will stand up and either say, I urge you not to concur with this, and let's go discuss it with our House colleagues and see if we can work it out. Or she'll say, let's concur with it and do as much good with the bill now as we can and come back next year in college sports. I don't know what she'll do. But generally, people are going to go along with what the prime sponsor asks on their bill.
Last one is Senate File 120, and this just came up because I saw it in the news, and it kind of piqued my curiosity. And this is the returning gun rights to nonviolent felons. And there's a lot more involved in the bill, but essentially that's it. So I wanted to get your opinion on this, because there seems to be, you know, a little bit on both sides, which there are on any given topic. But what is your feeling on this? Is it necessary? Is it right? Is it proper? What are your thoughts on it?
So Senate File 120, Restoration of Civil Rights to Nonviolent Felons, is one piece of a much larger movement that is sweeping the nation and has been underway in Wyoming for the last decade. And that is, how long do you continue to punish somebody for their past crimes? How long? If they did the crime and they've done the time, you know, they serve their jail time, they serve their prison time, they serve their probation and parole time, and years have elapsed since that, and they've paid their taxes, supported their family, held a job, not broken any laws, is there any reason to continue to say you have no civil rights? And so that's been going across the nation, where state after state has said, you know, maybe a lifetime of punishment is too much. And so the Wyoming legislature, starting about 10 years ago, had a series of bills, started out with nonviolent misdemeanors, petty offenses. You know, at some point you get to expunge it off your record. And I supported those things. You know, at first I was taken aback by it a little bit, but I thought, you know, at some point enough is enough. You know, it's at what point is the punishment enough? And the other thing that kind of motivated me, and I'm talking about the earlier bills now, like on some of these petty offenses and misdemeanors, there was a time, Aaron, when those went away, right? So you're a young man and you're in, you know, you're in junior college and you're out, you know, one too many beers one night and you, I don't know, you damage something and you get charged with petty vandalism and, you know, you go to municipal court and you pay a fine and that's it. And then it goes, you know, it's a hard copy file that, you know, 7 years later just gets shredded and it goes away. I'll tell you what, nowadays, nothing goes away. Nothing. And so it's a different day and a different age. I'll give you an example. One of my brothers had a college friend. They were going to Canada to golf. They got stopped at the border. And one of them, they looked at his passport and said, you cannot enter Canada. Your right to entry has been suspended due to your criminal record. What? So he gets abandoned at the border, you know, has to come home. Well, what happened? He's 40 years old. When they were 19 in college, they went to one of those little mini racetrack places. You know what I'm talking about?
Yep.
And he's in the little mini racetrack car and drunk, right? And takes it off the track and takes it for a spin in the parking lot of the discount store, the Kmart or something next door. Well, it got reported as stolen. He gets popped for joyriding and pays a fine, you know, as a misdemeanor, and it went away. Well, now, because of 911 or whatever, they seem to be sweeping the computers everywhere in the country, and offenses that you thought were long gone are popping up. And that's not an isolated incident. I was getting my passport that rapid reentry thing, you know, and so you have to go and be fingerprinted and photographed and all that sort of thing. And while I'm there, the guy next to me, he's in there trying to get his passport straightened out. What happened to him? Some misdemeanor offense that was 30 years old. All of a sudden, boom, it shows up. He can't leave the country. You know, so why don't we just, why don't we get real? And when things are that old and they've done the, just expunged them. The bill that we're talking about here does not expunge it. The record still exists. But if you committed a felony, but it was nonviolent, you've done the time, you've done the probation or whatever, and years have elapsed, you've been good, you haven't broken any laws, you've supported your family, you paid your taxes, you held a job, here's your civil rights back, including the right to go hunting. And I voted for it. I voted for it. Now, when it first came in, it was much broader than that. And so I wasn't ready to support it, but it got amended. It got amended in a number of ways. And I said, okay, I'm willing to support that.
Thank you for the explanation. Those are the questions I have for you this week, Senator. You're about ready to wrap up the session, I believe on Friday. So there may not be anything left to say, really, but I guess here's your opportunity to talk to all of us back here in Sheridan and Johnson counties and just I don't know, say what you would like to say to all of your constituents back home.
What I'd like to say is thank you for the opportunity to serve representing you in Cheyenne in the Wyoming Senate. It's a honor. I'm humbled by the support that I received at prior elections, and I'm down here to do my level best to make sure that I represent your interests to the best of my ability. And thank you for that opportunity. It is an honor.
All right, that'll do. Thank you very much, Senator Dave Kinski, in the current legislative session in Cheyenne, which wraps up on Friday. Thank you so much for joining us this year, Senator, and keeping us updated on all the happenings in Cheyenne.
Thanks for having me, Aaron. I look forward to seeing you back home.